This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Mira Sivisothi. It's World Mental Health Day today. It's usually observed on October 10th every year. And the focus this year is mental health in the workplace. How does it affect productivity? How do employers support mental health issues? How can they do it even better? I suppose HR plays a huge role in this. Joining me today to explore mental health in the workplace is psychologist Dr. Anjula Singh Bass. Welcome to the show. How are you today?
I'm very well. Thanks for having me, Mira.
Not a problem. Our phone lines are open. So if you have a question for Anjula, just give us a call. The number is 03-77-109-000. You can tweet BFM Radio or WhatsApp 018-789-8899. Anjula, how serious is mental health in the workplace? Obviously it's serious that the WHO has decided to have a theme on it today for World Mental Health Day.
Well, actually, it's a very serious issue. There's no research per se and statistics and numbers in Malaysia. But if we were to just take America and studies that have been done, recent studies by Harvard Business School and the public health department there, 44% of Americans are affected by workplace stress. So it takes quite a toll. And, quite often people try to segregate personal with professional, but it's all integrated. So it's affecting many verticals.
It does. We've spoken to quite a number of people to ask them what their issues are as far as mental health and the workplace is concerned. And funny that you mentioned that sometimes the whole work-life balance seems to be a problem. And this question, maybe you can respond to this.
Any advice when it comes to managing better work-life balance, given that there's all this work flexibility around the working hours, but on the flip side, it can spill over into personal life once you get back from work. So how to manage and make sure that there's that clear line between work versus bringing it back home, and what can employers do to help employees with that?
So that's a good question. The first step is being aware. Some people are working so hard that they don't realize, there is an imbalance. The thing is, exercise is one of the most underutilized activities to combat stress. It's free. The serotonins and the neurochemicals that are released really, really help with mental health and with stress. And having said that, it's also, a perspective in this day and age when we look at capitalist societies and on social media, being really busy is almost a badge of honor, but it's actually chaotic. And even tweaking the way we perceive, our life philosophy, which is, are we working to live or are we living to work? So it begins with things like that. I can tell you that employers are not doing enough, at least in this part of the world, in Malaysia. And that will start with reducing the mystery and the enigma and the stigma of mental health, because that's just one component of your overall health. There's no need to, force a dichotomy between the physical and the mental health. It's all very interconnected and related. And, I always tell patients, clients, there's no shame if we have a heart problem and we go to a cardiologist. So similarly, you need a leg up and you're feeling sad or feeling stressed, there ought to be no shame. And so it does start with the workplace and HR creating a culture. So, everybody needs to pull their weight.
In some countries, you are not allowed to attend to emails after work hours. In fact, your employer can be taken to task for that. Do you think we need something like that drastic enough to actually manage this work-life balance? I mean, think about it. Back in the day, we didn't have gadgets, we didn't have tablets, we didn't have smartphones. Mm. So, we didn't bring work home. Now we're constantly checking emails even after 8 o'clock at night. It's almost become a habit. What are your thoughts on that? Should we just put a hard stop to it?
Well, a hard stop would perhaps be ideal, but not realistic. Maybe a sort of gradual fading out. But it starts with the leadership of a company. When your boss emails you at 10 p.m., it's pretty natural for an employee to think, I need to respond, right? So one thing is to model these principles. And another thing is, largely the psychology of workplaces, we might have an occasional program or, a hotline that you can call, but most workplaces look at it as a gift that they're bestowing on the employee, like a requisite, like the bare minimum. It's not facilitating a culture of health. And even if you give financial incentives, which some companies do, that'll result in behavior changes, but it's not attitudinal. Mm-hmm. And so that passion to live a balanced life is not part of the culture. So it's kind of viewed just more of a bribe. But definitely you bring up an important point, because whether it's social media or just, you know, digitalization, addiction rates of that have skyrocketed.
Yes.
In fact, there are hotels in some places in the world, and I wish we'd start that here in Malaysia, where you have to check in your mobile device at the hotel. So food for thought.
There will be ramifications of that. It's almost cold turkey sometimes when I wonder if I had to do it myself. Question from one of our listeners.
So which job or occupation do you think is more susceptible to mental health issues?
That's an interesting question. I have a lot of clients that ask me that too. Probably on some level they want to switch to that job that I suggest. But the thing is, you know, mental health and stress is a combination of genetics, environment, cultural, social factors. In all honesty, I'd answer that you're just exchanging one set of complications for another. I have people in finance who obviously the bottom line is usually, you know, an Excel sheet and money and earning. And they find that very stressful. And they think, you know, perhaps if I were to become a painter, that would be more relaxed. But at the end of the day, you have a creative that is very worried about their next paycheck and, you know, how to get their work, let's say, shown in a gallery. So it's less about which occupation, but it's more about self-empowerment and how you manage it.
The grass always looks green on the other
Absolutely.
Side, doesn't it? Okay. Typically, based on your experience, what are the mental health issues that are tied to the workplace?
Understaffing, overworking, excessive hours. A lot of clients talk about the fact that they feel unanchored. They feel very frustrated because there's a lack of supervision. There's no clarity. There's no structure. These I would say are the main issues in a workplace, and then it spills into, you know, anxiety, lack of sleep, weight gain, weight loss, and then it starts to affect concentration and focus, and then before you know it, you've created a vicious cycle.
It is, yeah. Bullying, harassment, what about that?
Very common. You know, a lot of times, besides the obvious bullying and the harassment, even the way that people are spoken to, there's a lot of toxicity in the workplace. Yelling, screaming, even on emails, there's a equivalent of writing in all capital letters, which basically implies that you're being shouted at. So the abuse can take many forms, and it's very common.
We have a question here.
I have a staff in my organization who has a very aggressive behavior. She is preying on younger and new staff. She is very competent in her job, but because of her behavior, new staff cannot stay for long. She is a major source of stress for my organization. I don't want to lose her, but at the same time, I have to tackle this problem. How do I go about tackling this problem?
Well, in psychology, we say that, you know, don't dislike the person, dislike the behavior. And, you know, it is very tempting to just be dismissive of that behavior and write it off as, you know, a rude person, a bullying person, an angry person. And, you know, superficially, all of that may appear to be true. But what I think would be the best approach is to sit down and have a non-threatening dialogue and trying to understand, you know, on one level, she or he may not even be aware that their behavior is coming across like that. But if they are, to find out what the underlying mechanisms are, maybe that person feels a lot of stress or they feel threatened. There's no job security, or they, you know, they want to write out what they perceive as competition. And at the end of the day, it's something that needs to be addressed because it's affecting your bottom line. You know, whilst I understand that person is very competent at the work that they do, if they're driving out newer talent, that's going to cost the company, and it's not good for morale. So, you know, always a lot of times when I speak to clients, the biggest thing is, you know, they know there's an issue, they're aware of it, but they are a little bit insecure about their communication skills. But that can be easily rectified. And, you know, having a heart-to-heart and sitting with someone, sincerely trying to understand with neutrality, it goes a long way.
Let's talk about productivity. How does mental health in the workplace affect productivity? And some of the obvious signs that it is affecting productivity.
Well, a lot of clients will describe absolutely having an anxiety attack, a panic attack, you know, blanking out, not being able to deliver a report, staring at a screen, unable to write, unable to move. Eating diet is affected, eating too much, eating too less. That obviously has correlates with, you know, if you're constantly reaching out to a soda or a sugary sweet, then your BMI, you're at risk for diabetes. Sitting at long hours at the desk without getting up ergonomically, it'll cause back problems. So you're having a combination of physical and mental stress, and the productivity goes out the window. One of the basic building blocks before we try to prioritize anything is sleep. And a lot of clients are just ruminating at night, thinking over and over, what do I need to do? And, you know, the boss has called me in. What are they going to say? Am I going to be fired? Am I up for that promotion? So there are ways to stop that thought process. One good way is meditation, which I suggest, or just, you know, being present, mindful in that moment. But it's very interesting because the irony is the workplace is really, really pushing their employees, and they're thinking about the bottom line, but not addressing mental health actually costs everyone the bottom line. So if companies would look at it as their greatest investment, you'd have a very happy community and a very happy country.
Of course. We're discussing mental health in the workplace. It's the theme for this year's World Mental Health Day, which happens to be today. In the studio with me, Dr. Anjula Singh Bass. She's a psychologist. And when we come back, we will find out more about, whether or not we have how to support our co-workers in the workplace. Are there rules and regulations to reduce workplace mental health issues? I think a lot of everywhere I go, employees say to me, HR can do a lot more in championing mental health towards, you know, senior management and higher. So how do you convince HR to champion this cause? We'll discuss that coming up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. It's World Mental Health Day and this year's theme is mental health in the workplace. Joining us, Dr. Anjula Singh Bass. She's a psychologist and seems to have a special interest in mental health in the workplace. Anjula, why is that?
Well, as a psychologist, I have an interest in people. And people, at least in this day and age, spend most of their time at work. So you can almost describe work as your second family. You know, the dynamics and what's happening at work, getting along with other people, understanding temperaments, deadlines, multitasking, it sort of mirrors or parallels a family structure. And, you know, once I started practicing at the mind faculty, by default, if I were to see a correlation, the majority of my clients come with a workplace issue, whether it's, you know, work-life balance, an abusive, toxic environment, bullying, harassment. For females especially, this whole idea of imposter syndrome. No matter how talented I am, what kind of portfolio I have under my belt, how many degrees, in other words, how qualified I am, I still feel I'm not good enough. So even a gender dynamic at the workplace, right? But, the two things I see quite often in my practice is workplace stress and infidelity. And then it becomes really interesting because sometimes those things are tied to each other. In really high-pressure, high-stake environments, I deal specifically quite often with people who have a public profile. And a lot of these things come together and combine and often combust.
When you talk about workplace stress and infidelity, or the workplace and infidelity, what are underlying issues, Angela? I'm very curious.
If anybody stopped to think about it, it's rather common sense, because you're really tired, you're really stressed, you're working late hours, you're not at home for dinner, you're conversing, you may have the, you know, how does an attachment emotionally or mentally, like a fascination or interest or intrigue, start? A common shared interest or experience. And, you know, if two people, let's say, dislike their boss just as much as each other, and they bond over that, and then, you know, casual, what they think is inconsequential work lunches, then turn to speaking more and more by the copy machine, or, you know, going out to get a quick coffee, and one thing escalates to another. And the thing is, you're so tired, you're so stressed, you're so focused that the boundaries you might have had and what you know to be inappropriate or appropriate according to the understanding you and your partner or spouse have in the marriage kind of goes out the window. And that ties back to work-life balance.
How do you manage it then? Or how do you help them manage it?
Well, I always suggest to my clients that, you know, no is a full sentence. It's definitive. And what happens is a lot of my, you know, there's a cognitive distortion where you start, fortune telling, we call it. You start predicting, if I do this, my boss is absolutely going to respond this way. You know, this is what I think I know. But then I always challenge that with what we call reality testing. Have you seen your boss respond like this to this particular circumstance or situation? You know, for example, saying no to an unreasonable request or a last-minute request for more work or something like that. And my clients, you know, they say no. And I say, try it and test it. And you'd be very, very surprised at the results. They often, very often come back and say, the world didn't end. I didn't get fired. They managed to find a way. Life goes on. And it really starts with ourselves. Of course, the workplace, bosses, all of that, you know, it's a shared responsibility. But understanding that no means no, and I'm not going to take work home with me past a point, can really revitalize you.
Do you think we do that because of culture?
Which part? Saying no?
Saying no.
Not saying no.
Yes, not saying no. I apologize.
No,
yes.
No. Absolutely.
It's insubordination.
It is, exactly. South Asian culture, whether it's caste or social economic status, is very hierarchical. And at some point, you know, I always give this analogy, and it's quite powerful. You know, whether you're taking sort of a Malaysian Airlines flight or, Air Asia, Malindo, whichever flight, they always say, in the event of turbulence and the oxygen mask comes down, put it on yourself first. You know, not your spouse, not your child. Because if you do that, you have no oxygen, you will be dead. And therefore, you are of no service to anyone else. So first, please get your own house in order. De-stress, get that balance, understand, and it will feel very unnatural. We're so used to thinking, I can do it all, and that's a myth.
Okay. Coincidentally, speaking of the airlines, we have a question here.
As a pilot of a national airline, we are the frontliners of the company who deals with passengers and daily operation obstacles. Sitting behind the desk and facing the passengers daily is a different end of the table. Even though safety or fatigue report has been submitted daily, the company rarely sees this as a serious issue. The snowball effect will somehow arise and will lead to probably incident or accident in the future. The question is, how will the employer know what the stress level like in the real world?
Interesting.
That is a very interesting question. And it, you know, sort of boils down to perception as opposed to lived experience. You know, anytime I fly, I've read so much literature and research on the psychology of pilots and you know, deference. And it's very interesting, you know, in a South Asian culture. And I almost say that there's an ethical responsibility, especially in your field and profession, because, you know, lives of so many literally are in your hands, to make the employer understand. But it almost parallel the suggestion or guidance I'd give, let's say, to somebody who's afraid of public speaking. Quite often we make it about ourselves. I'm so afraid of public speaking. What about if I make a mistake? How will I sound? Things like that. And then when you switch that perception it's not actually about you. It is about your audience. What will they gain? What will they learn? You're serving your audience. Similarly, in one way to frame it is you're serving your passengers and so are your employers. So approaching them from that direction of the bottom line, what it would mean if there is almost a close mishap, you know, the pilot was tired and, you know, nearly clipped a plane or made a really bumpy landing. You can almost couch it as, you know, that would be a PR disaster. There's many ways to get your employer to notice. But then there's also you're taking a stance. I refuse to do this because I'm putting lives at risk. You know, ethically as doctors, as pilots, when we actually have the lives of other people in our hands, it's also up to us to take a stance.
But to be fair, the pilots do have a minimum requirement, or maximum amount of hours they can actually work. So I think the interesting question is, what does the employer know of, does everybody have different, you know, fatigue and stress levels, thresholds perhaps? So that's possibly something to think about as well. So what's stressful to you? I can probably take more stress than, you know, you can.
Yeah. Good point. In that one size doesn't fit all.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, having workshops, seminars, psychologists that can be on hand, there's personality, stress level assessments that can be done. A lot of multinationals, at least abroad, utilize these things where you can understand a person's sort of unique identity and temperament. And you do bring up a good point, because when we're trying to compare ourselves to others, there's no faster way to burnout, because, you know, everybody has a unique way of approaching situations and handling stress.
Let's talk about burnout. Often there seems to be a common issue employers face, burnout. How do you best manage burnout?
Not having the idea of too much too soon. So I think a lot of times it's, you know, people forget that we're human beings, not a human doing. In pursuit of the bottom line, it's a short-term gain mentality and not long-term sustainability. So we're burning the candle from both ends. And so, you know, one thing I would encourage in the workplace and with individual employees is that please don't be results-oriented. It's process-oriented, right? So when you're taking care of your physical health, when you're taking care of your mental health, they're both interrelated. You're not depleting yourself and making withdrawals. You're making a deposit, and you can go longer and faster. I think if you look at it, and I, you know, in the outside world, and I, when I'm speaking with my patients, it's as if they're running a, you know, 200-meter dash. But it's actually a marathon, so you need to pace yourself. You know, you may not get that quarterly earning that you want, but you'll be there for a long time, steadily climbing. And the paradoxical thing is, when you contribute to process and you have a process-oriented mindset, the results that you craved automatically take care of themselves.
Mm-hmm. So what do you do if your employer, you know, is not patient enough?
For in regards to burnout?
Yes. Well, to avoid burnout.
Yeah. Well, you know, at the end of the day, a lot of people, this is a thing in psychology we call functional fixedness. You know, when you're so stressed, you feel very stuck, understandably, and you feel like there are no options. I mean, as a last resort, you can always look for another employee, you know, slowly but steadily. There are employees or employers, rather, in Malaysia that are inculcating flexibility, good work programs, that are taking mental health seriously, incorporating it in sort of part of their ethos. So that is one option. But the thing is, if you don't learn how to manage stress on your own, you're going to be carrying that baggage to whatever employer that you decide to work for or work with, rather. You know, a lot of times people think these ideas are very simplistic, so they're too simple. They can't work, so they don't actually consistently employ it. But it's things like meditation. It's things like working out. There is that stigma of taking medicine, and sometimes we need a leg up to tackle that, right? So taking these things, these issues in your own hand, reading up, empowering yourself, But one of the greatest things is changing your thought process and how you approach that. In short, I'll say the quality of your thoughts determines the quality of your life. So it can actually work wonders.
Question?
Where is the line between being a high-performing, productive employee and being an overly stressed train wreck?
Great question. So very simply, think about what your success is costing you. So in psychology, we kind of look at it as a quadrant, you know, your professional life, your personal life, your social life, pastimes. Are you able, I'm not saying, you know, you fully need to score equally and evenly. You know, sometimes there will be times where you're focusing a little bit more on work or a little bit more on family because there's an emergency. But is it really skewed where, you know, work is 80% and the rest of the quadrant is 5%, something, something? You will know in yourself what that balance is and what that is costing you. And if you're unsure, you know, the greatest reflection or mirror is spouses, partners, friends. They will have an objectivity that you don't. And at the end of the day, you know, there's a lot of research that shows at the end of the life, people don't regret what they've done. They regret what they haven't done. Nobody says at the end of their life, you know, I wish I had bought that Mercedes or BMW. So you need to ask if it's worth it. And a lot of times in a South Asian culture context, it's achievement, achievement, the next raise, the next promotion. And it's very quantity-based, but the quality suffers. And that will take its toll. And it manifests psychosomatically, right? So whether it's, you know, hypertension, increasingly we're seeing people in their 30s having cardiovascular problems. And, you know, when it really gets to be too much, you know, early onset of cancer. So these are all things to be aware of and to consider.
You know, when you talk about work-life balance, I often tell people there is no such thing as work-life balance. And I think when you come to terms with it, it's a lot easier. You're less hard on yourself. There is no such thing as work-life balance, is my opinion. It's you try, but something at the end of the day has to give. What are your thoughts as a psychologist?
You may not be able to have it all to the same degree, but it is recommended and it is rewarding to try as much to come to an equilibrium, equanimity. Naturally, we follow cycles. We, you know, our natural craving, whether it's body or mind, is to reach a state of homeostasis. You know, when we're feeling really bad emotionally, psychologists call that cognitive dissonance. What we think is not matching up with what we're doing, and we feel, you know, very unbalanced. And like I said earlier, it's, you know, you may not achieve a 50-50, like, you know, an absolute weighing machine balance. But try to come as close as you can, because then all areas of your life will work together in harmony. I agree with what you're saying, but I don't think enough people try. When you have that thought, it's not possible, there is no work-life balance, and you continue on one trajectory, and then, you know, you combust like a comet.
I think sometimes just the thought of work-life balance is stressful. In that,
Why is that stressful?
I am not balancing. You keep imagining that you are not giving one particular area enough of yourself. And often it's the family. You often feel you're giving work much more attention than you are as far as the family is concerned. And then your conscience kicks in and then you're like trying your level best to do.
But see, I would reframe that in the sense that what we say to ourselves in the narrative and the ticker tape that's going on in our head is single-handedly the most important thing. It's very, very potent. That's problem-centric thinking. I'm not doing this, I'm not doing that. So there's a negativity about that. As human beings, we are not perfect. We're constantly seeking, learning, improving, tweaking, evolving. That's the point. So the way I would reframe that is, you know, we have to give ourselves a fair evaluation. Now, you know, sort of biologically and evolutionary, we're geared, unfortunately, to focus and hone in on the negative because that served a purpose in the past. What is the danger out there? And we're hypervigilant. But that's not necessary now in the age in which we live. So how many people ask themselves what they're doing right? When I ask my patients that what's right with this situation, they're just actually dumbfounded and stumped because they never thought about that. Mm-hmm. So first I start with, what am I doing right? And what is one thing I can improve? And what is one step I can take to improve that? And then once we start getting into that mindset, we're less stressed, creativity flourishes, and there are many ways to combine things where you creep closer to that ever-eluding balance.
Okay, and it makes you feel a lot better about yourself as well.
It does, absolutely.
Okay, we're discussing mental health in the workplace with Dr. Anjula Singh Bass. She's a psychologist. If you have a question for her, give us a call. The number is 03-77-109-1000. You can tweet BFM Radio or WhatsApp 018-789-8899. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Mira Sivasodi. It's World Mental Health Day and today's theme is mental health in the workplace. Dr. Anjula Singh Bass, a psychologist in the studio with us, trying to help us understand what it is that, you know, we are probably, it's just our approach, I think, what I'm taking away from what Anjula said in the last half an hour, 40 minutes or so. It's just us switching that mindset to being a lot more positive in our thinking when approaching issues at work, which are contributing to mental health in the workplace. Now, in the event that, what are the signs, Anjula, that you are crumbling and that you need help? We can go back and, you know, practice meditation and all of that, right? I mean, for those of us who it probably isn't a major problem, but what are the signs that you really need to get help?
Well, you know, to feel stressed, to feel sad, to feel upset are very, very human emotions. But when there starts to set in a feeling of overwhelm and finality and permanence, like there's no way I can finish this. There's no way that I can get this done on time, that I can, you know, make it right with my colleague or my boss, or this feeling of drowning. The word drowning actually comes up a lot when clients are describing the anxiety or panic attacks. I mean, it even manifests in physicality, you know, pulling out one's hair, you know, out of frustration or, you know, thoughts of self-harm. These are not to be taken lightly. These are real indicators that something is quite unbalanced at the moment. But the good news is, you know, with help, with therapy, with speaking to, you know, even speaking to HR can be a first step in trying to rectify. I know that in a Malaysian context and quite often in a South Asian context, it's easier said than done. But what I do want to emphasize is that people are much more powerful than they believe. On some level, we're expecting our employers or the workplace to just understand or do something or to lead. And we can often be waiting a long time for that. So I suggest that people take things in their own hands.
Question?
As an employee, how do you support your coworker who is experiencing mental health issues, and how can the organization support his job role?
Well, that's a great question, and I wish more colleagues would be concerned about that and would understand. So a lot of times, you know, well-meaning loved ones or colleagues will say, you know, depression is the number one reason for workplace absenteeism. And quite often, well-meaning colleagues or loved ones will say, you know, it's just mind over matter. You can do this. Get over it. It's just, you know, it's all in your head. And that actually can really set back the person who is experiencing depression. So one thing is, you know, learning how to speak about it. And there's a lot of great resources out there online. And employers would do well to, there's a lot of clinics that actually give workshops or symposiums on how to approach mental health, destigmatizing it, how to speak about it. I mean, one thing is for sure, that if someone confides in you or if you feel like they're having a problem, approach them and ask. You know, sometimes there is this mindset of it's none of my business or I don't want to offend that person, but that can actually be more hurtful. So there's a way to balance it without sort of encroaching on the territory, but is everything okay? You know, even the act of knowing that someone is concerned and you're not falling through the cracks or you're not oblivious, because a lot of times people suffering from depression feel invisible or that no one understands. And the last thing I said about that is, you know, the words we choose to use have a lot of power. So, you know, it won't suffice in, you know, in public parlance how we throw around commonly, "Oh, I'm so anxious. He's psycho. That's a schizo." It's very stigmatizing and does nothing for the people who are actually diagnosed or suffering from the real thing. And the one thing I'd say is we are not our diagnosis. So it's not, you know, that person's schizophrenic. That person has schizophrenia. So how we talk about it, the fact that we approach it, can go a long way.
Using the words very loosely. Okay.
Are there rules and regulations in place to reduce workplace mental health problems, such as limits on the number of hours people have to work, rules on the layout, lighting, ventilation of the place of work, as well as also to prevent work which is repetitive, which might encourage people to develop anxiety and depression?
A lot of concerns.
So the question is, what can we do about these things?
Yeah.
Well, like I said again, you know, we can put a pool table, a foosball table, and try to emulate the Google office. But why it works for Google is not just the props. It's an actual ethos and culture, which is hard to fake, right? So it needs to be authentic. But, you know, it would really behoove employers and, you know, the HR departments, especially because it's human resources, on doing the research, doing the homework. So painting the walls certain colors has different effects, which is, you know, why quite often, you know, the color psychology, which is why quite often, for example, hospitals are blue. So the colors, the interiors, fluorescent lighting is known to be very harsh. Putting screen protectors on the computers because the blue light that's emitting those rays, that really affects the sleep-wake cycle. So if you have employees that are deprived of sleep, we know quite often in war that's used as a torture tactic after a while. So, you know, there's a lot of things. That's the good news. You know, how about getting rid of the vending machine and replacing that? I mean, I'm sure there'll be protests at first, but your body will thank you. You know, just fruit everywhere. The quality of water, temperature, you know, you can gong a bell that in 90-minute intervals, people have to get up and stretch. And so there's many ways that we can effect these changes. And it would also be very helpful if we can educate people through manuals, through workshops, you know, through getaways and incentives. But the important thing is to start that conversation and know that it's a right.
Would you have a message this World Mental Health Day?
Yes. My message on World Mental Health Day is that, you know, when we talk about mental health and stigma, it's actually not just about stigma. It's an issue of justice. So I hope everyone will take that to heart and do their part, because it all starts with the individual, and then collectively we can make a change.
Thank you for joining us today. Dr. Anjula Singh Bass, a psychologist, this World Mental Health Day, themed Mental Health in the Workplace on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.